This is January 25th, and I'm William M. Jones, and today I'm interviewing Dr. Paul Dovery, president of Concordia College. And Paul, let's first just get the essentials of your biographical data. You were born where, you went to school where, and you worked where?
I was born on a farm near Mineota, Minnesota, which is west central Minnesota.
Okay.
In 1935. And
you're even going to give us that.
Absolutely. It's public information. And then we moved from that farm to a farm near Porter, Minnesota. I went to country school and then went to high school at Canby, Minnesota.
So was it a one-room country school?
Yes.
Is that right?
Yes. Not many people still have those stories stories in their biographies, but
Was it a good experience, the country school?
Yes, very good, very good.
Mm-hmm. I guess as with all school experience, it rises and falls on the strength of the teacher.
Sure. Yeah. But it was interesting. I remember when we came to that country school, I was in third grade, and there were fourth graders, and there were fifth graders, and there were seventh graders. There were not any eighth graders that year, but it was always fun. The way they'd go up for their science lesson or their history lesson, it was like the whole school was was in on it.
Yeah.
And it sort of universalized the learning process.
Yeah. And that can be disconcerting, but it can be stimulating.
Yeah. Yeah, it was.
So then you went to high school in Porter.
At Canby. At Canby, Minnesota, at high school. And then from there to Concordia.
Mm-hmm.
And after 2 years at Concordia, I was in the military 2 years. And then back at Concordia.
Was that during the Korean thing?
No, it was just at the end of it, 54 to 56. And Korea was over in, 53 or something.
Mm-hmm. And you served where then?
I was in Fort Bliss, Texas, for most of my service.
Mm-hmm.
In a communications radio unit.
Mm-hmm.
And then I returned and finished Concordia in 56, or 58 rather.
And you majored in what there?
In speech and economics.
Mm-hmm.
And decided those last 2 years that I wanted to go to graduate school in speech. And so I went to Northwestern in 1958-59, did my master's there. And one idea I had always in the back of my mind was the possibility of going to the seminary, going into the ministry. It had kind of been on the edge of my thinking, really, since I'd been in high school. And my graduate school advisor and I talked about that, and he said, well, why don't you apply for a Rockefeller Fellowship? It's designed for people like you who don't know that they want to go into the ministry but are serious enough about it to go and try it for a year.
Right, I remember those fellowships.
Mm-hmm. So I did that for a year, and it was a good experience. I was at Luther Seminary, now Luther Northwestern. And I think it was a very pivotal experience in my life, in that I had had the heady experience of graduate school, and I was able, after 1 year of that, to go to seminary for a year, which, in a sense, intellectually, kind of brought me up to speed theologically.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that has always been of great benefit to me.
I imagine you made some friends there that have been very helpful, too.
Sure.
As long as you've stayed within the Lutheran circle of activities.
That's true.
So much. Mm-hmm. Then back to Northwestern?
And back to Northwestern, right, where am I? Yeah, 61. And did my PhD work there.
Mm-hmm.
And then at the end of it, stayed on a year on the faculty while someone was off on leave. Then came to Concordia in 63. And the interesting thing
is... You came as a faculty member?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And then that same year, I had an invitation to go back to Northwestern as a permanent faculty member.
Mm-hmm.
Can you imagine the difficulty of...
That's a tough decision.
...choosing between a professional track, you know, where you'd be publishing and working with graduate students and all of the rest, and over against a liberal arts track with teaching emphasis. Sure. And it was not easy to make that decision.
No.
I'm sure I made the right decision, but it wasn't easy.
At the time, no. Yeah. I'm sure, because Northwestern is a prestigious institution.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so you were opting out of institutional loyalty and then some professional preference for that kind of ambience. Mm-hmm. So you came to Concordia as faculty member, and how long did you serve in that capacity?
I was a full-time faculty, I think, 4 years. And then in 1967, or 68, I get the years mixed up. It might have been 68. Then I became associate academic dean. Continued teaching part-time all through those years as associate dean and then dean. I followed Carl Bailey then as dean in 1970.
Mm-hmm.
And was in that position for 5 years until 75.
And you took the presidency.
Yeah.
Obviously, your life then has been pretty consumed by this one institution that is, amongst other things, my alma mater.
Yeah.
And I guess it would be of very great interest if we could touch on several themes and you kind of give a review of the changes that you've seen, the kind of sequence of trends and so on that you've observed as you involved with this institution. Let's first think about students. What were they like when you were a student, and how does that compare as we move on through the decades?
Well, I'm supposed to be from that quiet generation, the 50s.
where was that in evidence?
And I suppose it was true if you talked about activism. There wasn't any activism to speak of in the 50s.
Not a lot of cause-oriented.
No. Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, I think the commitment level of students was pretty high. That is, students took quite seriously their beliefs.
Mm-hmm.
And we talked a lot about that. We talked a lot about about religion and about politics, our coffee, our late night coffee and popcorn, or whatever conversations we had, that was certainly a focus. And I remember the
preoccupied with parties and women then.
No, that wasn't the case either.
Yeah.
But I recall, having political speakers and having theologians and others come to the campus. And. And I remember the kind of attendance, student attendance, faculty attendance at those events. It clearly was of some importance to all of us to be engaged in that way.
Mm-hmm.
And the people in my generation, I would say, were on the whole pretty hardworking people. I think we had we were born in the 30s. We grew up in the shadow of the Depression,
right?
And therefore, we were quite conscientious and serious about our business, pretty conservative from a financial point of view, and cautious in many ways. It seems to me we were cautious, but we were also committed to doing hard work.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I think a lot of us, when I think about it, did not have high aspirations for ourselves.
Still teaching, preaching, sort of the natural outgrowth of education.
Yes, and even at that, I mean, I think we didn't think about becoming leaders in the church or in business or in education. I mean, people went into all of those areas, but people didn't, by and large, think in very ambitious terms about their future. And I think also that was a kind of another part of the shadow.
Sure.
Of the 30s, that
security was
that's
all
right,
end all. Yeah.
And to have a good job, and to have a secure future, that was really quite important to all of us in those years. And I felt when I came to the college in the 60s. Now that's when Sputnik had really had its impact by then. And I sensed students were were more academic than they had been when I had been a student.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, I think I had some of the best student work I'd ever seen in the 60s, in terms of the project students would undertake and the kind of investment they would make, and I was impressed by the students of that period in terms of their willingness to really dig in.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm saying that from the period beginning in 1960, because I was teaching, you know, undergraduate students at Northwestern.
Sure.
From that period right through the more chaotic period of the late 60s, when students were distracted in a number
mm-hmm.
of ways.
Mm-hmm. Did that sort of ethos affect the Concordia campus in the late 60s and early 70s?
Sure, I think in different ways. You know, mm-hmm. We weren't, Concordia wasn't a hotbed of radicalism in that sense. Most institutions in this part of the world weren't. But you had the shadows again. I'll use that term. The shadows of it were there too.
Sure.
And we saw it in the cry of students for courses that were relevant.
Mm-hmm.
We were at that point in the late 60s in the process of reviewing our curriculum, and we came out of it, and the result certainly reflected a good deal of the upheaval that was going on in education.
Sure.
No question about it. Dropping of a requirement for the study of language, I think, would never have happened at another time in our history. I think it happened then because we weren't sure we could make a good enough case for it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
In the logic of that day.
Yeah, and one of the high priorities was student freedom of choice.
Yes,
and that
yes.
became more important than
right.
us imposing.
Right. Yep.
On them are preconditions as to what a college education would be.
And I was in the middle of a lot of the things that were happening at that time. I remember, for example, the consciousness about racism that occurred in the 60s, and I remember serving on the campus committee that was trying to develop a campus-wide program of awareness and education about those issues. I remember developing a bibliography and study guides that had use across the campus,
mm-hmm.
Developing an exchange program with what we then called a Negro college, a
sure.
black college in the South,
sure.
Virginia Union University.
Yeah.
And I remember those exchanges, and I remember all of the tensions that were fostered by the growing presence at that time of black students on our campus.
Mm-hmm.
I remember trying to arrange constructive expressions of concern and dissent on Vietnam, whether it had to do with putting parades together so that students who were protesting could do so in ways that wouldn't upset the rest of the student body who largely were opposed to them, or whether it were making arrangements for some kind of a truce, for a walkout at a commencement, and working on curriculum offerings that would focus on black studies and on the civil rights movement, and as the dean and the associate dean in those days, as I say, I was just in the middle of all of that.
Sure.
And
sure.
In retrospect, it was a period that had a profound influence on me. I'm still not quite sure I've taken its measure, but I know it did.
Yeah. Heady times in many ways.
They really were.
Yeah. Then we move on into the late 70s and on into the 80s.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
What do they look like now, these young people that you have?
I'm in a discussion group on Alan Bloom's book, you know, The Closing of the American Mind.
Yes.
And one consensus we've all come to, it's a group primarily made up of faculty members, and one consensus we've all come to is that our students are indeed committed to relativity,
mm-hmm.
to openness. It isn't that they don't think beliefs are important. They do. But they don't want to use their belief as a standard of judgment on anyone else. So the morality of individualism is certainly alive and well among
mm-hmm.
young people today.
Mm-hmm.
including those who come, as most of our students do, from strong religious backgrounds, and they maintain a strong religious commitment, most of them themselves, talk openly about it.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not to be applied, nor are any other moral strictures to be applied necessarily to someone else who sees it a different way.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's something that our whole society, I'm convinced, is experiencing, and it's one of the reasons that this society, I think, has such a hard time getting its act together about such fundamental matters as balancing the budget, for heaven's sakes.
Yeah.
We can't agree that...
and of course there's both a lack of commitment and a lack of courage that's represented there.
Right.
Yeah. And the word commitment has a different kind of meaning now, I guess. It certainly is far from absolute. It's a tentative sort of thing. And of course that's what Bloom is inveighing against.
Yeah, there's a kind of openness that we commend to our students, which is the openness to new ideas and to entertain all questions. That's the fundamental of the academy. But the kind of openness that says one idea is as good as another idea, not quite what we had in mind.
Yeah. Well, that really leads me into the next theme, and we've touched on it, but Concordia has been, it seems to me, remarkably successful in retaining its identity as a Lutheran college. It has had close association with the church, and it has maintained some of at least the conventional trappings that we associate with such a institution, chapel, consistently every day, four days a week anyway.
Yeah, every day.
And required religion courses. Do you see changes as you look back over the past in that particular dimension of the college?
In terms of the college and its commitment to the church and the church's commitment to the college, I think that's remained very strong. It's been a kind of a mutual admiration. And I think one of the reasons for that is that old Scandinavian polity, if you will, where you sort of like and trust each other and deal with each other in a kind of consensus context almost all the time. So the college has been spared in a remarkable way tension and confrontation in its relationship to the church. It has been a positive, evolving matter.
The sort of thing that, to differentiate you, for example, from Valparaiso, I would guess, where caught in some of the schism.
That's right.
That Missouri Synod has had to go through and so on.
Yes, that's right. We've really been spared that.
Mm-hmm.
And that's partly, you know, I talked about the sort of Norwegian style of things, and that's part of it. And I think the other part of it is simply the theological position of our church, in which we have emphasized our unity in essential matters and cultivated a great respect for diversity in other matters. So there's room for more than one theological point of view in the church and at the college. There's room for more than one polity, if you will, and room for more than one piety, if you will. And I think that respect for diversity within the context of an overarching unity is really the reason that Concordia and the church have retained a really strong tie and really strong commitment over the years.
I've had professional experience with several schools that have had a church relationship or a commitment along those lines. And of course, one of the difficult things is to balance the concept of academic freedom with the expectation of some kind of commitment on the part of the faculty. And seems to me you've done very well in that respect. Do you have any magic formula that would help anybody in that respect?
Yeah. Well, no, I don't know. I certainly don't. I think that one of the advantages that we have coming out of our tradition is the fact that the Lutheran denomination was born in the academy.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, Martin Luther and Melanchthon in particular had a strong commitment to academic freedom. And the Reformation was really premised on idea on the premise that any idea ought to be subject to examination.
Mm-hmm.
So Luther, you know, put forth his 95 theses because he said, here, this is what I believe and I'm willing to have this examined.
Right.
And I think that spirit, that scholastic spirit, if you will, which was part of the early Lutheran tradition, has continued to influence the style with which we look at the matters of academic freedom. And for that reason, we have felt that it is possible to have a conviction and still regard matters as being open to debate and examination. That commitment does not preclude, indeed it invites,
mm-hmm.
examination and analysis. So I think that's been a kind of residual strength of institutions like ours.
Is your student body, what proportion of your student body is Lutheran?
70%.
70%. Mm-hmm. So you have a pretty homogeneous
community. Yeah. But you know, interestingly, the next largest group, 10%, is Roman Catholic.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I think that reflects the ecumenical tradition of this area.
Mm-hmm.
You know, before it was really stylish to be ecumenical, this community was. I mean,
that's true.
A lot of people don't pick that up, but back in the 50s, St. Ansgar's had a fundraising campaign, and Joe Knutson was the honorary chair of it.
Sure.
Well, I mean, imagine that in the 50s.
Mm-hmm.
A Lutheran clergyman, president of a Lutheran college, chairing a fund drive for a Roman Catholic hospital. And but that was only one of many examples of dialogue that was actively underway as early as that.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that's continued, and we've had Roman Catholics teaching in our religion department. We had a Roman Catholic scholar in residence on a couple of different occasions. Father Bill Merkins is over on our campus with some frequency from the Newman Center here at Morehead State University. And I think those things have all helped.
Mm-hmm.
You know, naturally, religious practice has changed, and religious attitudes have changed, and we've noticed that too. Students used to be much more loyal about going to chapel and being active in religious life than they are today.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean,
the overt sort of
those overt behaviors are certainly not what they were,
mm-hmm.
reflecting the secularity of our culture in general. There's no doubt about that.
Yeah. Concordia obviously has occupied a very special place in this community and in this region. And do you see any sequence of events or trends as far as that dimension of the life of the institution?
Yes, I do. I would say, going back to my earliest years on the faculty, our commitment to the community was seen primarily in terms of the education that we offered to young people and the presence of our faculty and staff in various activities that normally occur in any community. And I would say that what has happened since then is that we really have branched out, and we have moved our understanding of involvement to and service in the community into a variety of other arenas as well. I would mention, for example, the Caris Ecumenical Center, which functions in a broad service way throughout this area, primarily to clergy, but increasingly to lay people too. Or the FM Communiversity, which was really a child of our institution,
right.
Which has a pretty long history now. And then a rather broad movement to be involved in a variety of ways in the community by members of our faculty and staff, whether it's the YMCA or the United Way or whatever it may be. Our involvement in the arts, of course, is longstanding with the music events that have been offered to the community by the college for a long, long time. and participation in Plains Art and FM Symphony and all of those things in a variety of different ways.
Right.
And most recently, for example, I think of the of this education consortium that's going on with the schools in this area, the rural-based small schools, and both Morehead State University and ourselves are involved as partners in that venture.
Mm-hmm.
And the West Central Regional Development Council, which I served on the planning committee for that, and Maury Lanning continues as a member of that board. And now we've just recently established a leadership center, which is intended to provide resources for leadership development to this entire area. So I guess I would say that we have been more active in regional
mm-hmm.
Service activities in the past 20 years than we were before that.
Mm-hmm.
And I expect that trend to continue to be there.
Mm-hmm. The you know, when we talk about branching out from the campus in various ways, Tri-College University is also an obvious.
Oh, obvious, yeah.
And you were clearly must have been involved in the birth pangs of that particular effort. Do you want to give us your sense of its beginnings and its state of relative maturity, I guess, now?
Well, that was a really exciting time back in, I think, 67, 68, when I was first doing administrative work. And, you know, there was a tri-college, I forget what they called it, there was something in place at the time. Three deans had gotten together, Carl Bailey, Seth Russell, and I forget who it was from Morehead State at that time. I don't know who it was.
Might have been Bob Hansen, but I'm not sure, or even Roland.
But they had sat together and agreed on some plan so that students could go back and forth, and it had been publicized in a modest way. But in that year, 67, 68, we posed a more dramatic question about extending our partnership. And certainly we were urged on by many federal and state agencies who were encouraging greater cooperation.
Mm-hmm.
So it isn't that we took that act in isolation. There were certainly a lot of things that were encouraging us. And that was evident in the higher education coordinating boards and the Board of Higher Education in North Dakota, both in Minnesota and North Dakota, the chair, Bud Sinner in North Dakota, and the commissioner in Minnesota, whose name I don't remember right now. Hawk.
Dick Hawk.
Mm-hmm. You know, they were personally interested and saw this potential here. And so we started really moving on that and taking it seriously. And it was a great education for me because I was a rookie administrative person and I was intrigued by all of this. And so I was kind of the scribe, if you will, that first year.
Mm-hmm.
And I was the point person for developing the proposals and bringing them to this group of presidents and deans and other people. And I must say it was a very heady,
mm-hmm.
a very heady kind of experience for a person as young to this kind of work as I was. So, in some sense, I kind of cut my eye teeth, if you will, as an administrator in tri-college business.
Mm-hmm.
And was involved then in the grants that brought us the startup money for the next year when Al Anderson came on board. Well, it was 2 years later, I guess, 69, 70, when Al Anderson came on board then as the first full-time person to move it.
Quite a move at that point.
Yeah, it sure was.
Yeah.
And, you know, the delightful thing was there was never any question. All three institutions, you know, put their money down from day one. It wasn't ever a question of whether or not they would be involved. Everybody said yes.
It really was a remarkable effort. I wasn't involved until 1972, but it took a lot of courage in some respects. Probably all three institutions, maybe more for Concordia than some, because the differential as far as tuition is concerned was considerable. But the benefits were also so clearly in evidence.
Yeah, there were certainly some in our shop who thought this was not a good thing for us to do.
Mm-hmm.
But there wasn't, I mean, that was a minority opinion. Mm-hmm. Most people thought it was a good thing to do. I was always impressed from the very beginning at the remarkable support from the presidents. Neumeier was president at first, you know,
right.
And then Roland, and I mean, and Laurel and Joe Knutson, I mean, it was just always clear that they thought this was an idea that we needed to implement.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it makes a lot of difference when that attitude is clear.
Oh,
at
absolutely.
The leadership level. Everybody,
you're dead if you don't have
yeah,
it.
Everybody
yeah.
just really pitched.
Right.
Pitched
yeah.
in behind it.
Yeah. Well, that's always been a impressive accomplishment, it seems to me.
Yeah.
The institution has done remarkably well, it seems to me, from an administrative point of view, in this terrible, terrible struggle of keeping quality up and still developing the resources to
yeah.
guarantee that quality. And how would you describe, again, the progression of trends as far as Concordia's status in that respect? The degree of... I have no idea. I lost track of Concordia for a while back when you arrived in the 60s. I have no idea of how they were fixed there as far as enrollment and as far as... resources as compared, for example, with where you are today.
Yeah. Well, I must say it was fairly humble. But then again, it's all relative to where everybody else
sure.
is. But
the campus
in comparison to today,
was far from complete at that
yes,
point.
Yes, right,
mm-hmm.
right. Most
mm-hmm.
of the major building occurred in the 60s and 70s,
yeah.
so
yeah.
when I arrived, we were just on the front end of that building splurge.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And the enrollment splurge. We had, I'm thinking 1,700 or 1,800 students when I arrived.
Mm-hmm.
And we had phase one of the library in place, but I think we had 25% of the faculty with PhDs, and, you know, enrollment was splurging, and where do you find people in the
sure.
early 60s? It was
sure.
just a real struggle. And the salaries for the beginning teachers were competitive, but not for anybody else.
Mm-hmm.
And
had to depend on institutional loyalty.
Faculty understood it and supported it, but
yeah.
it was not easy going.
Yeah.
That salary range was pretty
compressed
from the bottom to the top. Was a pretty short range.
Yeah. Yeah.
And the book collection. The impressive thing to me when I came was the kind of foresight that I found at Concordia, and I'm sure I would never have come. Had it not been for Carl Bailey's vision for the college.
Mm-hmm.
Because he showed me the blueprint that he and the group had put together. And it was a blueprint for the future of Concordia. And it talked about program, and it talked about faculty salaries and faculty benefits, but mostly it was about program and about buildings and about mission. And it was a far-sighted piece of work. And what impressed me from the first day I was on the campus was the future orientation of the college. Because the fall faculty workshop, you know, it was where we've come and what we have mm-hmm. to do next. It was always that sense of momentum about where we're going and the things we've got to do. And it was this incredible faith that we would find a way to get there. And that was, I think, this just carried and brought a lot of us here and carried a lot of us.
Mm-hmm.
That sense of expectation for
now,
the future.
Was Joe Knutson present when you were?
Sure.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Remarkable stability.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. As far as administration.
Yeah.
That's certainly...
Well, Joe had that gift for picking good people and then just saying, here, do this mm-hmm. job now, and then supporting them.
Yeah.
And that's really the...
That's a
the
key,
track.
Key, all right.
Yeah, it was.
Yeah.
And I think having Bills, maybe, who knew numbers, and Carl, who really knew... Carl was the master planner, one would have to say that.
Mm-hmm.
He was the one who gave the logic to it.
Mm-hmm.
But everybody else believed it. I mean, everybody else
yeah.
was behind it.
Yeah.
And that really made a tremendous impact.
What's your percentage of PhDs now?
60, I suppose, yeah. 62.
Yeah. It's very respectable.
Yeah.
There are so many different dimensions, and obviously I'm focusing on Concordia, but I suppose we really ought to say a little bit about your family and your own personal life and what you like to do outside of Concordia, so we get the whole Paul Dubry down here.
Yeah, yeah. Well, there are four of us, and Marty was a teacher when we were married. She's a Concordia graduate too. We met here. We always joke that we met at Oak Grove because she was practice teaching at Oak Grove High School in Fargo. And I was the debate coach over there, you know, just a few hours a week.
Sure.
And so that's where we literally met.
Sure.
And so she has been a teacher more or less all of her life, except for a few years, and continues as a half-day teacher at Fargo South High School. And we have a daughter who's an attorney in Minneapolis and a son who's in medical school at the University of Minnesota.
Mm-hmm.
Our son is married. We have a lake cabin on Bad Medicine Lake, and that's been a kind of family center for us for years and years and years. Everybody likes to be there.
Oh, that's great.
And so we have, and then we've also had another family tradition of going skiing in the Christmas holiday period. And did it again this year. We don't know how many years we can make it work, but
that's terrific.
But it's gone well.
Yeah, yeah.
And Marty and I also have liked to travel and have had a chance to do a fair amount of that over the years. A lot of it in connection with the job, of course.
Sure.
That is on this side of the Atlantic, and also on the other side, Norway. I guess on two occasions with the choir.
Sure.
On tour, and so it's been a good. A good experience for us.
Had you ever imagined, as you thought about your career when you were in college, that this might be your eventual destination as president?
No, and I think in that respect, I'm representative of the 50s. We didn't have those kinds of aspirations.
Sure.
And no, the first time someone talked to me about being president of the college was, I think, in about 1970, and it just scared me. I said, "Don't talk about it," because it wasn't anything I had ever thought of doing.
Yeah,
and I certainly wasn't ready to do it. And so in a sense, I backed into it. You know, I mean, truly, it's not a job that I had planned on. I think I just happened to be at the right place and get the right kind of experience, so that the college, in a sense, thought I was a logical successor to Knutson. I knew the institution, and yet I'd been in other places too, and so it was just kind of coincidence.
Mm-hmm. As you look back on this this career, I think it would be worthwhile for you to for us to benefit from your sense of what gave you what has given you the most satisfaction during the. You look back, you know, okay, there are some landmarks along the way, some events, some people, some programs. What comes to mind as you think that?
Well, the most satisfying things are the people things, and yet you can't put a handle on that so well. But seeing the graduates and finding out what they're doing and just tracking them a little bit is, I think, the most satisfying thing any person in education finds. I feel the same way about the faculty, watching faculty that you had a part in selecting.
And nurturing along.
And nurturing along.
Right.
And watching the impact that they've made, and the future impact that they'll make. Those are the things that I think give you the most personal satisfaction, but they are, you know, they're not as visible, I guess. I would say that that on a program side, or on the side of the things that you can touch and talk about, we had when I became president, we had a substantial hurdle in terms of our physical plant. We had desperately needed a science center for a long time. And yet we were trapped into thinking that we couldn't ever build anything that cost more than $1 million. Because the C-400 Club was our major fundraising vehicle.
Right.
And they liked projects of $700,000 or $750,000 or $1 million at the most.
Doable within a reasonable length of time.
And we needed a science hall. We knew that would cost $4 or $5 million. And how in the world could we get that done? And the lack of it was a real impediment for us. And so we figured out we had to find a way to do that. And our constituency was not used to the idea of a major giving effort or a major campaign. It was anathema, in fact. And so we said, well, we've got to do something. And did a study, you know, and the study came in. And what did the study say? I guess we said we needed $10.75 million to do the things that we needed to have done in a 3 or 4 year period. And the study said you ought to have 25% of the commitments before you undertake such an effort. Well, that would have been $2.5 million or more. And even that was a very liberal statement, 25%. You know, a lot of people say half.
That's right.
Well, we came to our Board of Regents with a recommendation to go forward with that, and I think we had $220,000 committed to it. And
a leap into the unknown. Huh?
And I remember I gave that speech to the Board of Regents. I said, you know, we've never done this, and there isn't any indication that we can do it. But we need to do it. Mm-hmm. This institution needs to do this if we're going to keep on course with our destiny. We simply have to take this kind of a leap of faith, and they voted unanimously to do so. Mm. And that was, you know, I've sometimes thought if I'd have known better, I probably wouldn't have done it.
You were early in your...
I was.
Frustration.
I was too innocent to know any better. But obviously it worked.
Yeah.
And there was something about doing that. Something about taking that kind of a move and doing something big,
mm-hmm.
that kind of stretched everyone's imagination,
mm-hmm.
for what the institution really could do.
Yeah.
And I think that got us moving. And I think we continue to experience that momentum as an mm-hmm. institution. Now we're talking about a centennial effort,
mm-hmm.
in large numbers,
mm-hmm.
40 some million dollars possibly. And we dare to talk in those terms now, because mm-hmm. our people have been able to think and talk in larger terms. So I think that has been of signal importance to us. And in there have been many kind of benefits from it. I think the people at the college have developed a sense of well-being. And I think it's developed a sense of pride and self-consciousness.
No question.
That has really helped us yep. as an institution.
Yep. Don't have to apologize for anything.
That's right.
Yep.
And I think that as we've been able to strengthen our faculty and the faculty compensation and all of the growth and development opportunities that are now available to our faculty, and as numbers of faculty become prominent and productive in ways that extend beyond the campus, that all of that has been, you know, good for the well-being of the college.
Mm-hmm.
And seeing additional curriculum change and seeing the Language Village program just absolutely explode.
Boom. Yeah.
I mean, these are things that have happened that have really been very encouraging.
As you look to the future, let's talk about one other thing that I find very interesting. A liberal arts college is a very fragile institution, really. Because society has not really embraced liberal arts graduates to the degree that we think they ought to.
Mm-hmm.
It ought to. And in the thus to respond to both the needs of society and the demands of prospective students, you also introduce programs that probably are not pure liberal arts, and that's certainly been true of Concordia.
No, sure. Historically, it's been true.
Right. Of course, we can say that teaching was the first such mm-hmm. Effort. How do you see that balance now and in the future? Is the direction towards ultimately a comprehensive university of some kind with that kind of variety of specialties dignified by being more than just programs, or where are you going in that respect?
Well, I think for a while we were moving in the direction of the comprehensive university and college, in the sense that the programs, the applied programs, were growing just by leaps and bounds.
Yeah.
And I don't know that people really stopped and thought about where that was taking us. But then about 4 years ago, we did a major self-study of our academic program called An Agenda for Concordia's Academic Life. And out of that came a very strong reaffirmation of the centrality of the liberal arts to what we are as an institution, and the sense that we need to define any new program initiative out of that context. Historically, we have not said no to applied fields. Indeed, given where our students come from and where we are kind of on the edge of the frontier and in the rural area, there's no other way to do it. Because people are going to say, what's the practical application of what I am doing? So we've always had to answer that question, and we'll still have to. But I sense our faculty has a stronger view on the centrality of the liberal arts to what we are than we've had in the past.
Mm-hmm.
And it's interesting, as that idea has been nurtured among our faculty and staff, that we find the students also are kind
sharing
of hearkening to that.
Yeah.
And it's just kind of fun to hear students when we talk to them as they leave the college, and then as we survey them years after they've attended the college. We have a survey, active survey of our alums every few years, in which we ask them to evaluate their experience. And as time passes, their affirmations grow even stronger about the validity of the liberal arts in their preparation.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess I feel better about the place of the liberal arts at our college, and I think I would say that about higher education in general than I felt just 2 years ago. I think
well,
there's a certain kind of renaissance.
The popularity of Bloom's book, for example, which is obviously an apology for liberal arts defined about as pure as you can get, it demonstrates, I guess, that there is an undercurrent of...
There's a strong, just to talk a bit more about this commitment on the part of the faculty, you know, almost all of our faculty people, I think 90%, came out of an academy that was specialized. And therefore, you know, to say that all of a sudden you're going to come into a liberal arts college and you're going to be a Renaissance teacher, that's just wishful thinking.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's been one of the problems of liberal arts institutions. We have been giving lip service to a myth. And one of the things we've neglected is to, as members of the academic community, to come to terms with what it means for us to be liberally educated people and liberal arts teachers. I mean, I think that's a tough one.
Good.
And we've been, you know, trying to address that, and the faculty has really engaged themselves in that exercise. So,
well, the faculty are caught too.
Sure, they are.
Professional advancement, unfortunately, is still dependent on specialized research, and it is still, if you have a commitment to a discipline, it's still fun to be able to do the advanced things with advanced students and not have to do some of the other things that seem more onerous, at least to some of them. But if the institution really is committed and finds the right kind of faculty and then nurtures them, that's what you're trying to do. Yeah.
Well, the tensions are, I mean, certainly I don't want to underemphasize, or I don't want to ignore the fact that the tensions are there. I think that's...
Yeah.
And they're going to be.
Yeah, it's inevitable, but you can live with tension if it's reasonably creative.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. Well, I think we've covered everything that I felt was important to get from you, but if I've left anything out, the agenda is open. Are there other things that you think ought to be perpetuated on this tape as part of this
program? Well, one thing I think that that you would hear from many of the college presidents here is the very unique relationship between the academy and the community. This is just a unique arrangement that we have in this community.
Mm-hmm.
It's hard to find an academy-community relationship as that has as many parts to it and that is as uniformly, mutually affirming as this one is.
Mm-hmm.
That should be said for posterity to hear.
Definitely. That's really a very significant thing. No question about that. Yeah, and that's been true almost from the
beginning. Yeah, it really has.
Yeah. Religion is a part of that.
Yes.
Because the predominant religion is Lutheran.
Mm-hmm.
But and certainly that's a very, very supportive part of it. But I guess it's not exclusively that by any means. Yeah. Okay. Well. It's been a pleasure.
Good. Well, I've enjoyed it too.